Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Ian Tuttle of National Review in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today as usual. Ian, I was very tempted to make Michigan State going to the Final Four the good martini today, but I've been informed that not every conservative cheers for the Spartans. So we're going to just make that a footnote today and hope that by next year, more of them do. On to the real good martini. We already have one Republican officially in the race. That's Texas Senator Ted Cruz. To the surprise of very few people, it looks like 2010 Senate candidate in California, Carly Fiorina, the former CEO of Hewlett-Packard, it says she's extremely likely to join this race. She told Chris Wallace on Fox News Sunday there's a 90% chance she will get in. She says she just has to make sure she has the right team assembled and that sort of thing. And so, Ian, I think a lot of conservatives wouldn't make Carly Fiorina their first choice. I think a lot of them probably think she doesn't have much of a chance to win. But she does bring something very important to the table. She's a woman, and she's willing to take the gloves off and take it to Hillary Clinton. Here's a couple of clips of that. This one is from, I believe, CPAC a few weeks ago, where she went after Mrs. Clinton's record as Secretary of State.
Unlike Mrs. Clinton, I know that flying is an activity, not an accomplishment. I have met Vladimir Putin, and I know that his ambition will not be deterred by a gimmicky red reset button. Mrs. Clinton, please name an accomplishment.
And even yesterday on Fox News Sunday, the issue of Hillary's emails came up, and Carly Fiorina was very much on the aggressive there, too.
But I also think there's a competence issue now. Anyone in 2015 to say you can't have two email accounts on a single device obviously doesn't understand technology. When she talks about we had Secret Service agents guarding our server, for heaven's sakes, we're not concerned about the server being stolen. We're concerned about the server being hacked.
A little preview of our bad martini there too, Ian. But Carly Fiorina plays a great role in this race. She may be angling for a VP slot, probably wouldn't get that either. But ultimately, she is in a unique position to really lay the wood to Hillary Clinton for a good year here.
That's right. It's very difficult to see a path to the nomination for Carly Fiorina. And I do think that she's certainly entering the race very seriously. You don't take this type of step just sort of on a whim. But one of the things that I think people ought to be aware of is she's not to be underestimated. I've had the pleasure recently of sitting down and chatting with Ms. Fiorina. She is a very competent, very articulate, very powerful speaker on a number of issues. She's not to be pigeonholed as sort of another Herman Cain or someone who is trying to jump outside the box of her economic accomplishments. I think she has a really good grasp of a number of the things she's talking about, even on the foreign policy side. So don't hold me to this, but I would suspect that come the debates, which begin in August, and there'll be one a month after that, a lot of people are going to be surprised and hopefully pleasantly surprised at someone who overperforms. A key part of that, as you say, Greg, will be the fact that she gets to go out and say some of the things, unfortunately, that other people can't say. And that's going to be terrific, not just because it's a Republican woman saying this, but because it's a Republican woman who is able to say this and a lot more. I think that she's not just going to be a battering ram against Hillary, good though that'll be, but a very powerful presence on the debate stage, perhaps in some of those early primaries. And with that in mind, she might help to sort of move, shape, reform the field a little bit. There's a lot of room for that.
Definitely an intriguing entry into the field and somebody who could definitely shake it up. And who knows, maybe she could make a run towards the nomination. She certainly would be an interesting choice for a cabinet secretary if a Republican could win the White House. Before you get the hate mail from the Herman Cain supporters, I'm just going to assume you weren't in love with 999.
You know, it wasn't my my ideal campaign strategy, but you know, one of the things, just real briefly, Herman Cain had a real sort of breakout moment, raised something like $10 million in a day and a half or 2 days, but didn't have the team in place to capitalize on that opportunity. Republicans need to be very aware of the importance of the ground game. That's something that Obama certainly showed us these past two elections, is it boils down to individual votes in individual precincts. Republicans have been bad on that, very bad on that in recent years. And talking with Carly Fiorina and looking at the way some things are unfolding sort of behind the scenes for a number of different candidates, it looks like there's a renewed attention to assembling the necessary infrastructure, money, teams, et cetera, to make sure that when candidates have a windfall, or, you know, once they've perhaps won that initial primary, they have the momentum to keep going and actually make a run with it. That was part of Kane's problem early on. I hope that Republican candidates won't make the same mistake this go round.
As referenced early on in our discussion on the good martini, the bad martini today is a story that broke, I believe, late Friday, and that is that the Benghazi Select Committee in the House of Representatives, chaired by Trey Gowdy, will not be getting any more of Hillary Clinton's emails other than the ream upon ream that she actually printed out to hand over to the committee. And that's because there's nothing left there to actually hand over. David Kendall, that's a name you might remember from back in the late 90s. He was one of the Clinton lawyers during the whole Clinton-Lewinsky scandal. And he says, he's her lawyer again now, to avoid prolonging a discussion that would be academic, I have confirmed with the secretary's IT support that no emails for the time period January 21st, 2009 through February 1st, 2013 reside on the server or on any backup systems associated with the server. Ian, those were under subpoena, so depending on when that server got wiped, this might not just be political machinations to avoid a political scandal. There could be criminal conduct here.
There could be. Of course, the reality is that the Clintons are sort of always exempt from the consequences of their actions, at least under the law, which is one of the great injustices of modern American political life. It's really just unreal, this whole thing. You know, the fact that it came out on Friday night is just sort of perfectly indicative of exactly what we've come to expect from the Clintons. I've said this before on this show, and a million other people have said it, but this whole episode so epitomizes the entire Clinton ethos, which is that we're above the law. Even when the law is clear, it might very well be that they wiped the server despite the subpoena on Thursday evening and just know that nothing is going to happen, because that's the way the Clintons operate. At a certain point, you're just sort of left without anything to say. The good news to this, the small silver lining, is that Hillary Clinton's unfavorables, even among Democrats, during the period of this whole server scandal, are skyrocketing. And it's very, very interesting. You start to think that the Clintons will suffer no consequences, not even political ones, for their various misdeeds and shenanigans. And that's not always true. That might not make its way to the ballot box, but at least right now, it does look like there's some sort of backlash among ordinary Americans, prospective voters. That's a small silver lining.
Let's hope Americans have a long memory. That's not always the case in politics, clearly, but we can always hope. All right, on to the crazy martini now, Ian. And last week, Indiana, the legislature passed. The governor there, Mike Pence, signed legislation known as the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. It's modeled after federal law that President Clinton actually signed back in the early part of his first term. Over 20 other states already have this. Arkansas just passed its own a day later. But Mike Pence and Indiana are the ones at the center of the liberal storm. There's the Boycott Indiana effort underway. You've got the mayor of Seattle banning city-funded travel to anywhere in Indiana because effectively they think it's discrimination against gays. Ultimately, it leaves business owners the right of conscience to not violate their closely held religious beliefs. Mike Pence, as we mentioned, the governor of Indiana, was on This Week with George Stephanopoulos and had this to say.
Is tolerance a two-way street or not? I mean, you know, there's a lot of talk about tolerance in this country today having to do with people on the left. But here Indiana steps forward to protect the constitutional rights and privileges of freedom of religion for people of faith and families of faith in our state. And this avalanche of intolerance that's been poured on our state is just outrageous.
And for those who haven't followed the story, obviously we've had wedding cake bakers and florists and photographers essentially being forced by the courts to service gay weddings in states where that is legal. And then these people feel, of course, that their religious freedom rights have been violated. So that's the crux of the issue here. Interesting debate, but interesting more so how the media seems to be demonizing Mike Pence in Indiana in the last few days.
Yeah, it's really extraordinary. The whole this idea of boycotting Indiana over this is just nuts. But it's politically effective. It allows the left broadly to create a political firestorm that plays into their base, that allows them to talk up these crazy Republicans as religious fanatics. You know, all the same stuff that we've seen over the past several election cycles. It's nothing new. It'll die down. The real issue here, though, is that it's illustrative of the real sort of heart of liberalism nowadays. If you look back at the original federal RFRA that was passed in 1993, it was signed by Clinton. I believe the co-sponsor was Chuck Schumer. Ted Kennedy delivered a glowing speech about how important this was on the Senate floor. It's had long standing bipartisan support. But what's happened in the interim is essentially the element of the left in America that had any sort of respect for religious liberty has died off, and it's become a party and more broadly a philosophy so obsessed with the buzzword of equality that it's willing to trample on far more fundamental rights. If you go back to Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America, he has a very powerful section, I believe it's in the second volume, where he says Americans struggle with negotiating the tension between liberty and equality. And he says equality ultimately is far more emotionally powerful, and they'll choose equality even if it means sacrificing their liberty. And he's very concerned about this temptation. That's exactly what's happened, compelled by the left, is they refuse, or they're very willing to reject the fundamental liberty that the founding fathers wanted to place in our Constitution of freedom of religion. They're very happy to let go of that, or even trample that liberty, if it means equality in their sort of nebulous definition of it. It's very troubling, and it should be troubling to all thinking Americans.
Ian, always great to have you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much, Greg.
Ian Tuttle of National Review, in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us again on Tuesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.